I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Time to take KSL Outdoors. This is Utah's most listened to program about hunting, fishing, camping, and high adventure. All the gear you need to buy, where the fish are biting, and secret places in Utah and around the world where you can have a blast. KSL Outdoors with host Tim Hughes on KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
And we welcome you back into hour number two, and of course the final one for another week of KSL Outdoors Radio. Pleasure to have you with us here on what turns out to be a rainy Saturday. Temperature is going to be nice and cool, too, about 20 degrees less than we have had for most of the last week or 10 days. And it does look like as we get into next week, we'll settle into more normal-like temperatures, which means mid-80s down here in the valley. And lows tonight going to be in the 50s. You'll want to bundle up if you're headed to the high country to get away from it all, which I wouldn't blame you at all if that's in your plans. Nice to have you here. Russ has stepped aside for a minute, but Navi's still with us, Navidomskis. And we're going to talk more fishing here. You thought you were done, but no. We've got more fishing, and we're happy to welcome into the conversation Randy Opplinger, the Sport Fish Coordinator for the Division of Wildlife Resources. Randy, how are you?
Hey, not too bad. How are you doing, Tim?
Doing really well. I said at the beginning of the show that I've always wondered if tagging fish was a good idea for things like tournaments. Why not use it as sort of a research mechanism? And it sounds like that's what you've decided to do here.
That is absolutely what we've decided to do. You know, there's a lot of good information that we could potentially get from tagged fish. And, you know, honestly, we do tagged fish efforts, you know, for the public in terms of fish contests. And then internally, we tag fish to get biological data. So what we're actually looking at doing is merging the two and tagging some fish, making them available for the public. And we're basically asking the public to report on a webpage the tagged fish that they catch. And what this does is we're able to garner a little bit more biological information, particularly some just fishing information, catch rate information, and it gives us just better information about what anglers are catching and just what their experience are. Are they happy with the fish they're catching, or if there's things that we can do as a division to make them a little bit more satisfied with what they're catching.
Pretty cool, Navi, right?
I totally agree, Tim. And what is interesting is people think that there's this expansive number of fish that, you know, catching the fish with a tag is like catching in 1,000, but really, you catch them often. There isn't that many, and it proves that you can actually overfish a fishery.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do have fisheries that do get overfished, and that's a big part of this effort is we're able to use the information and look at how often these tagged fish are caught and gives us an idea of maybe where overfishing is happening. And then as a division, we can adjust accordingly so we can decide whether there's waters out there where maybe we should stock a few more fish just because we see that anglers are catching maybe a few more than we anticipated they were catching.
So the program is already up and running as of the 15th, and it's at community fishing ponds. How many?
We've got a total of 5 community fishing ponds that we're doing this at right now. And really, we're kind of at a study phase. What we're doing is we put these tagged fish in the ponds, and there's a webpage, and it's printed right on the tag. So if you catch a tagged fish, you're able to go to the webpage on there. And we're basically asking anglers just to enter some information about their catch. So their tag number, we ask them the species they caught, where they caught it. And again, just some questions, you know, were you happy with your experience today? Did you like the fish that you catch? And any comments that you have for us.
Is this something that will also help with your fishing reports, or is it strictly research?
You know, it really is strictly research right now, you know, but I think in the end of the day, it's probably going to benefit in terms of our fishing report. So in other words, we're probably not going to report the information per se, you know, on number of tagged fish that were caught, you know, on our fishing reports. But as I mentioned earlier, what we'll be able to do is use this information long term and start identifying waters in the state where maybe we need to change how we stock. So I think down the road, it's going to probably be a benefit for our fishing reports because hopefully, you know, in waters where maybe fishing reports have traditionally haven't been very good, we might put some tagged fish out and find out that the reason for that is maybe we're not stocking the right number or right size of fish and be able to adjust and make the fishing better down the road.
That's cool.
What ponds did you put them in? You said you put them in community ponds. Can you name those?
I cannot name those. And the reason for that is this is a research study that we're doing right now. So this
is a new thing for us. It's important that the audience is blind.
This is a new thing for us. This is a research study that we're doing at this time. So what we're doing is on these ponds that we put the fish in, we got the tag fish in. Mm. And at the same time, we're doing what's just a traditional creel survey. So these are surveys where we send one of our biologists out and we have them talk to anglers and have them get information about what they're catching. And then we're also asking people on our Fish Utah webpage to provide rating information. So that webpage has a rating feature where you can provide some feedback for us. And what we're basically doing on these five community ponds is we are comparing all three of them head to head to head. And we're seeing how this tag fish effort kind of stacks up to these other things. The creel surveys are something that we've been doing for the last probably 50 plus years. We know that they're really good. And we see this tag fish effort is another way to collect very similar data to the creel survey. So right now we're doing the study, and the reason we're not putting the names of the ponds out there is what we want to do is keep the use of these ponds as normal as possible during this study period.
Yeah, when Navi asked the question, it dawned on me that you would actually create artificial surges in those areas, and you'd get heavier pressure than it otherwise would, which already sets your research a little off.
Exactly. This is about us trying to keep the use of these ponds as normal as possible. So we're hoping to keep the pressure like it would be traditionally. So that's why we're not releasing the names right now. I think if you look down the road, what we're doing right now is really modeled after something Idaho's been doing for the last 15 or so years, and they've had really good luck with it. We're kind of taking this in a maybe a slightly different direction, but based on Idaho's experience, we think this is going to go really well here in Utah. Hmm. And then we're going to probably roll this out a little bit more broadly here down the road. And when we get down the road, I think, you know, it leaves this research phase and we're really doing this larger scale here in the state. We probably will let the public know which waters have the tag fish in them.
Can you tell us what Idaho concluded? Can you tell us their experience and why you think this is a possible good thing for Utah?
Idaho's done it for a couple things, actually. One thing they've done a little bit more recently is they've been evaluating their stocking fish in the state using these tag fish program. The one benefit of a tag fish program is we could tag a lot of fish, and it doesn't cost a lot of money to do. So we could do this on a lot of waters in the state. And that's what Idaho's done. They do this on about half their waters every year. And what they're finding is, like I kind of alluded to earlier, waters where maybe they're overstocking their fish and waters where maybe they're understocking their fish. So what they've been able to do is really dial in their stocking rates and make sure that they're stocking appropriately so anglers have really a consistent experience in Idaho. So you don't have waters where you go and you never catch any fish. They're able to dial that in and get the stocking right in those waters.
Well, that helps with your budgets on the other end, too, I would imagine.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, that's a big thing for us. You know, we want anglers to go out and be satisfied with their fishing experience. We want people to be able to go out and catch fish. You know, and getting this information from anglers is important to us, and that's what the tag fish program does. Is getting this information from anglers lets us know what anglers actually experience when they go out and they go fishing. And again, this helps us dial what we're doing in better, spend our money more efficiently, allocate our fish a little bit better, and make just better decisions on how we're stocking fish in the state, again, for the benefit of the anglers, so anglers just have better fishing success here in Utah.
Nice. Very nice.
Is it a particular species, or can you even give us that information?
It is rainbow trout, I will tell you that. And down the road, you know, we could do this for other species, so it's going to work for any species we do. And Idaho's even done it with non-stocked fish. They've started this by actually collecting wild fish, and they were getting an idea of how many of these wild fish were being caught. So we could use this in a lot of different ways. It's pretty flexible. But right now, we're just testing rainbow trout with this.
So 10% of the fish have been tagged, but there's something we've held out information-wise here, and that is 1% of those are going to include a bit of a bounty for the angler.
That is correct, and actually there's something that's even better associated with that, and it's actually 10% of those have the $40 bounty associated with them. So the idea is basically for every 100 fish that we stock out, 10 of those fish are going to have a tag. 9 of those tags don't have any reward value associated with them, and the other one has a $40 reward assigned to it. So that basically means that if you're at one of these waters, you got a 1 in 100 chance of catching a fish that's got a $40 reward attached to it.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. No, I see why they didn't tell us where.
Yeah. So obviously we've mentioned this is up and running now as of September 15th. I guess I'll be curious anyway, and I'm sure you are too, at how quickly some of this information starts to come back to you.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, we just stocked the fish, what, 2 days ago, 3 days ago. I checked this morning. We haven't had any tags reported yet. So, you know, but I think, you know, we put them in the week, and the weekend's coming, and we'll see what happens this weekend.
Yeah. All right. That's cool stuff. We wanted to make sure we got that information out there, and we'll twist Randy's arm when we get off the air to find out which ponds are actually the ones that are stocked.
Hey, Tim, most importantly, don't underestimate our community ponds. They're a lot of fun. Get out there and fish.
Yeah, and I know yours up there around your home in Kaysville was a regular haunt for Finn. He's probably too busy for that these days. But
oh, he was dean of that river, no question. I mean, it was a lake, but a pond, but he knew everything, and people called him all the time.
Yeah. Randy, it's always a pleasure catching up to you, and I know we say this every time we wrap a conversation, but we appreciate you not just for the time you spend with us, but for the effort and the energy that you and your entire team put in to make sure that our fisheries stay the way they are and keep producing great fish for people to get out and have some fun.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot, Tim, and, you know, thanks a lot for your end, just getting this information out to the public, because, you know, we're looking for the public to provide us feedback on their fishing, because it really helps us do a better job. So what you're doing really helps us out as well.
Awesome. All right, we need to take a break. When we come back, Bob Grove will be here. Mark Wade has the week off. We'll find out where he's hiding. Hopefully he's off on a one-tank trip of his own with his family. But Bob will help us out as we head to West Yellowstone. That's next on this week's KSL Outdoors Radio.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, thanks again to Randy Opplinger, and that tag fish thing really sounds like a great benefit and fun for fishermen, although you don't know where they've actually stocked those five community ponds, but you know, the more fishing you go do, the better chance you have of figuring that out. So there's some encouragement to get out. If you want more information, I guess just go to wildlife.utah.gov. Time for our one-tank trip of the week, at least our first segment. We're short on time here to get to a news update on the half hour, and that means we, as always, make a connection with Bob Grove, who tells me Mark Wade, I guess, is off on his own adventure this week, huh?
Yeah, he went off to Lake Powell with his brother.
Oh.
You know, he invited me along, but I said, well, someone's got to stay behind to do the one-tank trip of the week.
That was big of you, Bob, really. I'm going to guess that's not the real story, but...
No, I was actually invited. In fact, I turned down 2 Lake Powell trips this summer, a full week on a houseboat with a friend of mine, and then with Mark and his brother. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm just not... straight in the head.
Do me a favor, the next time that happens, instead of pretending you're taking one for the team, just reach out to me, and if it's people I can get along with, I'm happy to go.
Okay.
I'll take your place on the boat.
I'll remember that. Yeah, it's I'm too much of a workaholic, I guess. I don't know.
You guys been busy this week?
Yeah, we were up in well, we're in Wayne County most of last week, and we're following up from our trip up there. We're doing a lot of work up in Wayne County, and it's just keeping us hopping. And then in Beaver County, we're doing some work up there as well. You know, these rural counties are very active in their marketing right now, repositioning, rebranding, doing a lot of different work to try to remodel how to do business these days.
I think the last two pictures I saw posted from you were the surface of the moon or Mars or something.
Oh, yeah. Last week we were on both Mars and the moon.
You took a wrong turn somewhere. That one tank trip became quite the ride.
I don't know what happened, but, you know, all of a sudden gravity took us away. That is such a fascinating area. If you between Capitol Reef and Hanksville and the Caneville Desert, there is just, I mean, that's where the Mars study area is, where they have that pod there where guys go out and try to simulate Mars existence.
Huh.
It's just really crazy.
What's the name of that valley you were looking down on?
Well, we were at Moonscape Overlook by Factory Butte.
So it's actually named Moonscape.
Yeah, Moonscape Overlook, and we're looking out towards, you know, to the east, and not far from there is Goblin Valley, the San Rafael Swell, and then you get these painted desert-like mounds that is called Mars.
Yeah. If people want to see some of those pictures, and I know Mark was also shooting some drone footage, again, it's roadtrippingwithbobandmark.com for information. That's not where we were headed this week. We're actually going to go up to one of our favorite spots, and that is West Yellowstone.
Yeah, I wanted to, you know, I haven't been up there in a while, and so I thought this would be a good opportunity to head north. You know, West Yellowstone is near and dear to us both. We both have good friends up there that we've known for years, and such a popular destination. I like to do license plate checks when I travel to see where folks are coming from, and Utah is always really well represented in the parking lots in West Yellowstone.
Well, you can be there in 4.5 hours, isn't it? Or five, somewhere there.
Yeah, it's about that. It's about 350 miles from Salt Lake to West Yellowstone, and it's a scenic drive. And, you know, especially when you get up a little bit further north beyond Rexburg and so on, Highway 20, going up through Ashton. I like to take the scenic route, which is the Mesa Falls Scenic Byway, and stop and see the falls there.
Yeah, that's
And then
beautiful.
Head into Island Park. Yeah, it's beautiful. Those waterfalls are beautiful and such a pretty route. So that's generally, unless I'm in a hurry, and if I'm in a hurry and I stay on 20, it's still pretty scenic, but yeah, beautiful drive.
And the main attraction, obviously, is Yellowstone National Park, which I'm afraid many people here take for granted. But the fact is, most people, if they get the opportunity, do it once in a lifetime. And here we have it within a tank's drive. And how often do we take advantage of it?
Well, you know, it used to surprise me, but it really doesn't anymore, because I've found so many people who have lived in the Wasatch Front in parts of Utah all their life that haven't even seen Zion and Bryce.
True.
And our Mighty Five. But yeah, I mean, we've got from the Grand Canyon to Yellowstone, we've got some of the most bucket list national park destinations on Earth. People from all over the world come to see these parks. And guess what? They aren't this year. So it's a good time to visit them, because they're you're not going to see people from all over the world this year at the parks, although it is staying busy. I called our friend Alma Clark, who is the marketing director with Three Bear Lodge and See Yellowstone, to get caught up with what's going on up there. And I asked him how business has been this summer. And he says, actually, it's been fairly well, because those gaps that have been left by the international travelers have been filled in on the most part, not entirely, but by local and regional travelers. And he says they're getting a lot of folks from Texas coming up and visiting. And I'm not surprised at that, because we're seeing that a lot here in the Zion area as well.
Wonder what it is with Texas. Are they doing good outreach promotion down there or something?
Well, I think the state tourism office has done a pretty good job of promoting our area to Texas. Texas is a big market, inbound market. They do. I mean, Colorado just makes a killing out of Texas, but we do it really well as well. And I'm assuming that, you know, Montana and Wyoming and Idaho have done the same. They're big travelers. I mean, it's a big state with big travelers. Yeah. They like to travel, and we've seen a lot of them on the road this year.
We're up against the clock here, so we're going to take a break for news on the half hour. When we come back, though, as we start to make the change of seasons, I try to make this point every year, and of course, we've been up there snowmobiling in the wintertime, but many people do not even consider Yellowstone in the winter, and I always try to educate people that if you've been to Yellowstone umpteen times in the summertime, you still need to go back and see what it's like in the winter. And luckily, Bob and I don't have some of the same memories from snowmobiling up there.
I was just waiting. I was going, okay, 3, 2, 1.
Yeah. I won't bring it up next time if you don't, but we will talk about how much different it is and the fun that can still be had. If you don't mind some bitterly cold temperatures on some mornings, heading to Yellowstone in the winter is a whole different experience, and you can snowmobile into the park. We'll give you the details of that coming up here in the next half hour. So stay with us. That's just ahead on KSL, but first a news update. Don't go away.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.